Hello, iGaming Intelligentsia. Before we start today's podcast, here is a message from our sponsors. The iGaming Next podcast is made possible with the support from our sponsors at Pragmatic Solutions, leaders in intelligent platform technology. I've been working with Ashley, Lewis, and the guys over at Pragmatic Solutions over the last year. And as the early supporter of this podcast, I cannot recommend them enough. The Pragmatic Solutions Player Account Management Platform is an incredibly powerful technology stack for today's gaming business. Their modern modular platform provides all the core services to power your business, and their SaaS licensing model allows you to reduce cost and accelerate your strategic goals. Enterprise technology with decades of operational know-how at scale built in. Upgrade your business to the Pragmatic Solutions PAM platform. Visit www.pragmatic.solutions to arrange a platform demo.
Future trends, deep insights, industry leaders. This is the iGaming Next podcast with your host, Heidi Loftus.
Hi, Luke.
Hi, Heidi.
We are meeting in a podcast setup.
Yes, very much so, yes.
And it's you exciting. Are so welcome to our fabulous jungle room.
Yes, I love it. It's really, really cool.
Do you see I'm matching?
Yes, very much so, yes.
Yes.
me not so much so.
But you weren't aware of
it. No, that's true, yes.
And when you asked me if I did it intentionally, I said I was very, very well aware of the matching. Made You, that's you and Kelly McSherry.
Yes.
But what about Luke? Tell us a little bit about you. My first impression of you guys is, we have talked about this so many times, and how you're standing outside my office door going, you should have training. Everyone needs training.
Yes.
I invited you in to our boardroom and we talked and I said, we should have training. A few years later, I could actually have you guys into our bigger boardrooms and to our managers and running proper training with you.
Yes.
We even flew to London, flew to Stockholm.
Yes.
So good times. And I know that you are increasing in gaming, your clients, etc., which I can just say it's obvious because you give really, really good training, inspirations and proper team building.
Yep.
So in a different kind of setup, it's actually fun to do training with you guys.
Yes, very much so.
So why training? Give us a little bit of your background.
So I think with me and Kelly, particularly because we founded Made You, we were both working and living in London before we moved to Malta. And when we are working in senior positions, one of the things that we always noticed was that the training providers we brought in tended to be quite PowerPoint orientated. Mm-hmm. It kind of be quite dull, and our staff were basically falling asleep and not really learning anything. So when we moved to Malta, we realized that we could do training in a different way and make it much more operationally focused and also make it fun, because people learn more whilst they're engaging and having a good time together. And also it adds that kind of, if you've got a large group, it adds that team dynamic to it as well. So that's kind of where the training started off with. We start with a very small portfolio of courses, all soft skills kind of courses, management skills, leadership skills, even presentation skills, and then gradually built the portfolio from there because we were able to bring much more of our operational experience into training courses.
I mean, you can tell that you're so used to this standing, you know, the presentation. I've always been like, what should I do with my arms?
Yeah.
But you know, just you talking, it becomes very natural. So I'm gonna, you know, learn from you during this chat as well. All right, so Malta it is.
Mm-hmm.
Gaming mostly it is, or you feel like you want to be all over Malta, all industries, or?
I think at the moment, probably about 80% of our customer base, our client base is in gaming, definitely. And we have a few other businesses that we work quite heavily with, but they tend to have much more of a forward-thinking culture and a forward-thinking ethos. So I think if people understand the value of training and developing their teams in a different way that's much more engaging, them are the type of companies that are drawn to Made You, because that's what we basically do. And gaming tends to have that culture anyway, that energetic, fast-paced culture. But there are some other companies on the island that are bringing that kind of pace and focus to their culture as well. So those tend to be the people that gravitate to Meiji.
Two things on this. First, I'm going to do the arm things here. First, does gaming differentiate itself from other industries? Not only in Malta, but like in general. Is there typical training that is needed for gaming, people working in gaming? Can you see any sort of tendencies?
I think what we've noticed with gaming, possibly more than other businesses that we worked with typically in Malta and also across Europe, is it's so fast paced and it's growing at such a massive pace that people are getting promoted very quickly. And in other companies, you would build your tenure, you would build that skill set up before you got those promotions. And in gaming, it's happening so fast. So they're basically getting promotions and then realizing, I don't have these leadership skills, I don't have these management skills, because it is very different than what I thought it was. So that's when we can step in and really support those individuals through their transition into management roles, heads of roles, director roles, and even C-level roles. The pace of promotions within the gaming industry is phenomenal, and I think that's what we notice different.
Is that making your job more difficult? Adjusting or building courses for that kind of MO, or is it actually easier?
I think it's a bit of both, really. It's easier because we understand the industry, and I think that's why we're picking up a lot more gaming clients, because it is quite unique, not just in what its product offering is to its customer base, but also what's happening internally. So it's quite a unique industry. So I think because we have an understanding of that, it makes things easier. The way we do our training courses, particularly our training courses, is we tend to have kind of a skeleton course of the topic we want to talk about, and then we bespoke bits around it. So each client's getting a little bit of a nuance for their culture, their business, that might be different than their competitors or other people in the industry. So that bit isn't harder, but it just requires a bit more focus and engagement and partnership between us and maybe their HR team or whoever's sponsoring those kind of training courses.
You say because we understand the industry, you understand it because you play games or you've been working in the industry. What's your understanding of the industry?
I think our understanding is completely as a third party. I mean, we're basically doing training with a lot of gaming industry clients. We're also doing coaching, a lot of one-on-one coaching. So a lot of the information that's being shared tends to be quite similar. Obviously everything's confidential, but tends to be quite similar. So when we come back into the office and we're talking about our experiences of dealing with in training, coaching, team building, even 360 programs as well, we are understanding it from kind of the outsider's point of view. So rather than being a customer or having worked in the industry, we are working so heavily with people who are in the industry and at various different levels. I mean, going from C-level, where you're talking about the strategy of where we're going, the new markets, everything we're getting involved in, and sort of, you know, compliance issues, but new markets with compliance.
Exactly.
I mean, it's covering every base at every different level. So it really gives us a good background and also understanding what the nuances are about the industry, you know, the fast pace, the different elements, you know, that the gaming industry has to be involved in. And also there's a lot of buying of companies, merging of companies as well. So you're bringing two cultures that seem to us a little bit different. They're coming together as one new bigger company or being absorbed by a larger company. And that's also bringing its interesting points.
Mergers, acquisitions, clashes or sort of meltings of cultures. How big companies can you work with? Do you have any sort of maximum limit of...
Not really. I think it depends on what they're asking us to do. I would say our biggest piece of work tends to be 360 programs, because that's quite heavily involved. And the largest 360 we've done has been about 300-350 people. And that's a lot of engagement from our side. From training perspectives, it tends to be either one-off courses or putting people through programs together.
Exactly.
So new managers, new heads of, new C-levels, they go through the journey together. So that tends to be less heavy on our side. But from a size of the business point of view, I think 360 is the heaviest piece of work that we ever get involved in.
Let's get back to the 360. I spoke with Fiona Ewings-Brown from Catena earlier. Mm-hmm. We were discussing 360 and sort of the emotions around it. But we get back to that. We were talking about you guys being in Malta as well. Now, remote leadership trainings, how are you adjusting to that?
It's a very interesting situation for us because obviously when COVID hit and everyone suddenly were no longer in the office, it was very interesting for us because one of the USPs of our training courses is they're very fun, they're very engaging, exactly. And they're quite activity led. So there was about 4 weeks when we were reevaluating as a business, how do we do this in a remote setting but still make it engaging and fun? Because what we don't want is to go to a PowerPoint model. And I mean, I watch training videos on LinkedIn and it is, or I join seminars and it's just somebody reading the PowerPoint slides in front of them and you're basically watching it, so you're doing other things at the same time. So I didn't want that for me and you, and it was a conversation that me, Kelly and the other trainer, Rich, were having a conversation about. And we've managed to successfully get all of our courses into a remote setting, and still having these kind of group courses but in a remote setting, but being able to still have that full element. And technology has been phenomenal during COVID, the ability to tap into different technologies where you can still send people into a little room by themselves, even though it's a virtual room, to still do the activities that we would be doing sort of in a classroom environment. So it's been, I think there was about 4 weeks of challenge and then everything started to drop into place and we're like, right, we know how to do this in a made you way and still be effective. But what happened to our client base was literally everything stopped face to face for obvious reasons. And then gradually the demand started to come back saying, actually, we've got people who are suffering and because they don't know the work-life balance. We've got people who don't know how to manage people remotely. So how, you know, are you offering these kind of courses? So there was about 4 to 6 weeks where nothing was happening. And then suddenly the engagement came back as in, what can you do? And luckily the timings coincided with us being aware of what we could do at that point in a remote setting.
So the opportunities arose as well.
Completely.
You're going to continue having remote as an offering for the wider global market, perhaps? Or
I mean, one of the things we found, Heidi, is it's in some cases it's even more beneficial, especially in the gaming industry, because they've got people in different countries. And either traditionally when we were doing face-to-face, we would have, like you said, we would fly to London or we'd fly to Stockholm or we'd fly to Malmo and do training in a face-to-face environment with these other teams. We're now able to just bring people together in a remote setting. So it's helping us to reach our training across many different people, but also these people experiencing the training together and understanding together. So in some cases, especially with lots of different offices, we're bringing these people more closely together through training.
It's funny that you say that, because the coaching program, we have talked a lot about it, the coaching program that I took, quite a long one, that is normally only face-to-face outside Sweden, outside Stockholm in Sweden. Now, due to COVID, I could actually participate. So this is one of the Nordics' sort of biggest coaching programs. And the way, obviously, everything is digital, it's online. There is no weird thing about it. It's the new thing that we do. But I've also noticed that the clients that I take on now, there is no difference. Of course, it's super nice meeting face to face, but it's based on how you first have your discussion with your client. Then you can actually, I mean, there's nothing wrong with a phone call or doing the link. I mean, it's the relationship that you build through that channel, and it works just as well.
Completely.
You use other senses.
Yeah, very much so. And I think also being aware of even nuances. I mean, one of the things that we get is people who are saying, you know, I'm on a Zoom call and the person I'm talking to isn't always looking at me, and then reflecting back, well, if you were in a meeting room having a meeting, would you expect them to stare at you for an hour? And it's like, well, they wouldn't. So why are you expecting it on camera? So it's also knowing those nuances of when somebody's kind of, their body language changes, but is it because they're being distracted or is it being because they're just being thoughtful and they're thinking about what you've said? One of the other things we've noticed is typically those people who are less people orientated. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's more technical people or more engineers mm-hmm. who we would struggle with in a face-to-face coaching environment to build that relationship mm-hmm. tend to perform much better over a Zoom call or a remote coaching session because there's that kind of detachment mm-hmm. for them. So they feel much more safer opening mm-hmm. up because there's not somebody in the room physically with them. So it's
the
actually
comfort of their
completely.
Own homes.
So it's completely changed the dynamics. But yes, rapport building is really important. And mm-hmm. I think, as you will probably appreciate with the coaching that you do, is we don't ever pretend to be anything that we're not. We're going in as operational mm-hmm. coaches. We're not theoretical coaches. We're operational mm-hmm. coaches. So we build that rapport very quickly as and we understand what it's like to do these jobs. We've done them before, so we're just trying to help you to be a better version of yourself. We're not here to psychoanalyze you or be a bit more theoretical. We're here to guide you. So I think once that rapport is built, it doesn't matter if it's remote or face-to-face.
Should we dig a little bit deeper or just clarify the differences between theoretical and operational, mm-hmm. Both in training but also in coaching?
Yes, so our perspective, and obviously this is just our perspective of the difference between operational and theoretical, and this really comes from all of our experiences when we were employed, is there's a lot of theoretical trainers and theoretical coaches who are basically, their only ever job was a trainer or a coach. And ultimately, for a trainer, a theoretical trainer, they're teaching you textbook. They've researched the topic and they're presenting you with their research, which some of it is really valuable. You know, there's nothing wrong with the theoretical. Some of it's very valuable. A theoretical coach has never really worked in operations. They've always been a coach. Now, they can be effective, but sometimes there's going to be points with a client where they're stuck, and the theoretical coach would be saying, well, what do you think about that? How do you think you can move forward? Typical coaching questions. But the client doesn't know. There's nothing there. They haven't had any experience of that. A first-time team leader, for instance, isn't really going to know how to lead the team. A first-time head of isn't going to know how to do their budgets or their P&L. So it's like there's a blocker there. With an operational coach, as we've been there, we understand what it's like to do that. So we coach a lot, but when there's clearly a blocker, then we'll help you through it. This is how I would have approached it when I was doing it. How would you approach it based on that information? So we give a little bit in order to get past that kind of blocker. And from an operational training point of view, is I love a lot of the theory that's out there, but I would say at least 40% of it doesn't work in a real life situation. It's theoretical, it's idealism. So it's like, well, actually, what an operational trainer can do is they can look at all the theory, take out the bit that we just know doesn't work. It's lovely and it's an ideal world, but we don't work or live in an ideal world, so let's get rid of that and let's train people operationally. And I think the other thing I love about being an operational trainer is you stick us, any three of us, in a room training and then questions that come up from the delegates saying, well, what about this situation? Or I've got this particular issue. How would you deal with it? We're not caught off guard. We're not quoting theory. Oh, exactly. We're not looking in the back of our head to try and think of that book we read. It's like, well, actually, when I had that experience, this is how I dealt with it. And we're not saying this is the way they should, but we're able to give them something, which makes it much more operational.
And it feels, speaking from my experience, obviously as a ball plank, to sort of I get valid thoughts back or parallel sort of ways of thinking.
Completely.
Before moving on, we touched upon resistance a little bit. Obviously, everyone is not sort of super happy going on to trainings. I speak quite a lot with my different colleagues in the HR gaming world, but also in my private network. Some companies do mandatory training for their managers, team leaders, heads off. Some of them have it entirely optional. Obviously, if you go entirely optional, you have people that want to be there. And you sort of, you don't get the people that don't want to be there. And that could be all fine. Obviously, it's good if everyone leading a team can have the same sort of united approach towards their organizations. But, question to you. For those companies that do mandatory training, you will have... Don't tell me you never experienced any resistance, but there will be managers that might be happy to join in, but in the last minute they cancel and you don't really see anything of them or question things or, you know, you meet resistance. Yeah. How does one overcome that?
I think it depends on how the resistance is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if the resistance is coming during a session, particularly training more than anything else, because that's actually happening in the moment, mm-hmm. and you have a group that's also being affected by that,
mm-hmm.
is about how the trainer either deals with the issue and sort of confronts it in a kind of questioning way and trying to understand where that issue is coming from. What we tend to find is once we get into our training, there's less resistance because most of the time the resistance is coming from they think they're going to be sat in front of a PowerPoint presentation mm-hmm. for 3 or 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Typically in a face-to-face environment, once we get them out of the chair and they're starting to do activities with their team to reinforce the learning, that's when there's less of an ability to sit back and say, I'm not getting involved, because obviously they're feeling that, you know, this is something that they want to do, they want to get involved in, even if it's just to do the activity, and then the learning comes from that. A lot of the time that the negativity coming from, if it's outspoken, is coming from a place of either not understanding what the training's about and how it's going to help them,
mm-hmm.
and then the trainer can kind of have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
If we can't overcome it, then the person, if they're going to stay in the room, they will get learning because the learning's still presented out there,
mm-hmm.
but we do have to focus on the other people in the room. But typically, resistance for training mm-hmm. tends to come from people's preconceptions
yeah.
of what that will be.
Yeah.
And I think you touched on an important point, which is this mandatory training.
Mm-hmm.
I think also how the internal business communicates this is really important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I've just been promoted into a head of position,
mm-hmm.
and this is head of training, this should be communicated not as in I have to do it and you must do it. It must be communicated in a way that this is to help you develop into the head of role. This is going to give you skills and abilities to be a better head of. So I think it has to be mandatory in those kind of situations
mm-hmm.
because you need those skills, but how it's communicated is
yeah.
really important. I think for other kind of courses, like presentation skills is a prime example. Putting somebody
it's
on
a good one. It's a really good one
for mandatory. It's like, how is that communicated? Most people just say, right, you need to go on a presentation skills course, but why? Why do I need to go on a presentation
mm-hmm.
skills course? So if the client can explain to the individual why they have to go on that course, then they're much more open to coming in the room and getting the learning that they need from those kind of courses. But if somebody, if you think you're a good presenter and then your boss says you need to go on a presentation skills course, you're automatically going to walk in the room with me, you a little bit reluctant to do the course because you think you're amazing. So I think there's this kind of communication that needs to happen. And one of the things we notice with our more longer term clients that we work with is they have a really good HR team and department that are communicating in much more an effective
mm-hmm.
way, that it's seen as an opportunity. It's a great thing. It's something that's really going to help these people. And with Made You, it's going to be engaging and fun at the same time. That tends
exactly.
to dilute things
yeah.
a bit.
So it's not a waste of time.
Mm.
Like, I have more important things to do, which surely will happen.
Which everyone does.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone does that.
Completely.
But it's an interesting sort of, I got a parallel, like the sort of, you don't know what you get until you've actually passed it or done the class.
Completely.
So it's like selling a super sad movie to me. You know,
yeah.
I don't want to see a super sad movie, but it's so good. How do you can't miss it?
Yes.
Then shall I see this or not? I mean, there is a natural born reluctancy in me to actually see this film.
Completely.
Probably I will be super happy and, you know, enriched after having seen the film.
Yeah.
But there is resistance.
And I think one of the good things, I mean, both about the clients we work with, but also the industry itself,
mm-hmm.
is it's so fluid, the industry. People are moving from company to company.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as people talk, so it's like what we're noticing now is we've got senior people who were in a company we were very heavily involved with, still are, who've moved into a senior role in another
mm-hmm.
gaming company and are hearing, we need training, coming from the sort of mid-management and heads of level. And they're like, I know who to deal with because you'll love it. You know, we've been dealing with Made You
exactly.
and they're amazing and this is going to
mm-hmm.
give you what you need. So a lot of that kind of communication, even at the point where somebody has a course with us and they come back on the floor and say, oh my God, I've just had this great course, is quite phenomenal.
Mm.
And I think one of the interesting things for me and Kelly is when we revisit, so it's, for instance, if we do team leader training 2 years ago and then we're doing head of training and this person that we know from team leader training is now in head of, the fact that they can recall some of the training that they had, you know, like, oh, I learned this and I learned that, is quite amazing
yes.
to hear that presented back, because it's like, this is what the training that we deliver is about. It's installing the key learning that's going to stay with them.
In an operational way.
In a very operational
yeah.
way.
The theory is just coming along.
Completely.
Is there a difference between, what's the difference in terms of training between C-levels, heads off, managers in general?
I think with team leaders and managers, it tends to be quite management focused. Mm. A lot of the challenges they're having is about how to manage people effectively, particularly difficult conversations with underperformers, tends to be a real key topic for new managers, new team leaders, and even mid-managers who haven't really experienced it because they've managed this motivated team, they're all engaged, and then suddenly something happens in the industry or COVID, for instance, and performance drops and say, oh, I never had the opportunity to have a difficult conversation, it makes me nervous. So it tends to be these kind of core management courses, where there's heads of and C-level tends to be much more leadership courses. Mm. How do I drive the business forward? Mm. How do I negotiate with key partners? And particularly in this industry as well, how do I not negotiate with key partners and get a good deal for both of us? Presentation skills is becoming even more popular as a training course because a lot of people are having to present externally in things, you know,
exactly.
Where we are now, but also in regards to presenting internally, there's a lot more stand-ups, a lot more communication, whether it's remote or whether it's face-to-face. So these tend to be the more the leadership courses that we get involved in. What we typically see with heads of and C-level is they get value out of the leadership courses, but the coaching is the key gem for them, that one-on-one work where we're literally just spending time with that individual and getting them to grow as an individual. That
building the partnership.
Completely.
I noticed that when you were talking about the team leader and sort of manage your team, and especially with underperformance and disciplinary, I mean, it's a heavier subject. You did not act like that. You started to sort of positively move. Is that your sort of positive psychology background that plays into this, you think?
I think so. I think the way, I mean,
you can turn things into positive.
Completely. Yeah. And I think this comes from having operational experience. And this is a real key difference on a course between a theoretical trainer and an operational trainer. Is if a theoretical trainer hasn't been in the room and told somebody that they're going to lose their job if they don't perform better, they can't guide you through that. It's an experience which is quite an emotional experience as a manager to have that conversation. But I think it's empowering for both the manager and the individual. It's just about how you deal with it in the right way so that ultimately, as a business person, I want this person to be a better performer. That's what I want, because the costs involved with this person leaving, the team being under pressure because there's a headcount down, having to go to recruitment in this industry, highly competitive, and try and get a good person in, it's just too much, it's overwhelming. So my role is I want you to be better. So it does become quite empowering.
Exactly.
But you have the onus. You are an adult. You know, this is something we've got to remember about managers. They're managing adults. They're not managing children. So I have to empower you with that information. If you choose that you don't want that relationship with this particular business and me as your manager, there's not much else I can do about that. We just need to end the relationship. Mm. You need to move on to better things and I need to move on to better things, and then everyone's happy. So I think there's always a positive outcome in a difficult conversation. It doesn't make it any easier, but there's always that positive focus, which is this person's either going to improve or they're going to decide that they've got a better life with another company and I can get somebody who's more suited to me and my team. Mm. And that's still a positive outcome. So either way, it's going to go well. Yeah. It's just how you view that. But it doesn't make it an easier conversation. It just makes it much more positive.
But it's a proper good toolkit to bring Completely. Into the conversation.
Very much so, very much so.
So if I'm a company and I don't do training, what is it that I miss out on? Why should companies do training for the managers?
I think one of the key things that I've experienced in work, but also a lot of the research, especially the Gallup, we work a lot with Gallup, and that the research they've done is a lot of people leave businesses either because of their manager or because of things being affected by management overall. And so for me, it's fundamental that managers have the skills to manage. Mm-hmm. Heads of have the skills to lead. Directors and C-levels have the skills to run the business and develop strategy, because it all filters down. Mm-hmm. The people who are you wanting to retain, they need to feel that they're being invested in, but they also need to feel supported. Mm-hmm. That comes from key training. But also these people at these levels that need this training in order to do a better job, they also need to feel valued. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to go to a business where they're not valuing the skills I've got or the potential, which is even more important, to be even better than what I am. Mm-hmm. And that comes from training and coaching. Mm-hmm. And if I feel like you're investing in my development, mm-hmm. and I'm motivated by my own development and my own progression, then why would I go somewhere else? Mm-hmm. I can earn more money at another business, but I'm not going to be happy. The culture might say they're fine, but I don't want to just sit in the same job forever. I want to feel like I'm being tapped at my potential. Mm-hmm. One of the things we're noticing specifically in this industry is the people who have got better retention rates are the ones that are attempting to invest in their staff. They're, you know, acknowledging the potential and trying their best to tap into that by using various different training businesses, seminars, all those kind of different things. And I think Mayju's part of that. We're not the end solution, we are part of the solution.
You're definitely part of it, because if you're talking about personalization and sort of building my own path to grow in the company, I mean, you guys play quite a big deal in this. During the trainings, what has sort of impressed me quite a lot is, in one session you learn everyone's names, and you remember them for sort of the follow-up session, like the presentation skills one is obviously a two session in one. How much effort does that take? Like, it becomes a habit for you, but I mean, it the impression it gives, it's a massive one.
Yeah.
But so much concentration from your end, sort of putting everyone into their packets of names.
Yes. There's a lot of kind of positive psychology and even neuro-linguistic programming tools which say that the more that you use somebody's name, the more impact it has. It's supposed to be the greatest compliment to use somebody's name, and it's also a good way to reinforce learning.
Exactly.
So if I use your name when I'm trying to reinforce some learning, or when I am reinforcing learning and I add your name to it, it really goes into the brain. So it's a conscious effort that we have, not just to build that rapport, because it's a nice thing to do in a training course, is build that rapport, but also that we can use when we need to reinforce learning for particular individuals, that we can do that. It is an effort. It does come naturally now. There are some tricks that we do in training courses, and anyone that's observant will see what we do. And it's easier when there's two trainers doing it, like presentation skills, because I can remember half the room and Kelly can remember the other half the room, and then we swap. But there are some tips. I think specifically in more international companies, and we're dealing with multinational, international, various different cultures. Some, especially with my accent, sometimes it's hard to pronounce some of the names, but I give it a good go until I get it right. And I think as long as you're being aware that, you know, this is an attempt to recognize your name, it's a really good thing, but it is very conscious. So
we've been talking about training for team leaders, for managers, heads offs, and for the employees.
Yeah.
What trainings are there that sort of gives value back to the organizations as well?
We actually, there's a couple of companies that we do work with, particularly in the gaming industry, that are really investing in some of their core frontline teams. So particularly with customer service, we have a Wow the Customer course, which is really soft skills around good customer service, but it's not that preachy kind of theoretical course. It's much more engaging. It's really about getting the staff to understand what it's like to be a customer, and then using those experiences from their own personal point of view to bring it to how they could improve the customer service they're doing. So that's an amazing course for customer service.
Positive attitude.
Completely,
kind of thing.
Yes. And it's a really cool course as well for those particular individuals. And it's something new, it's something different. You know, soft skills training, particularly in a CS induction, is something that probably takes 2 hours because there's so much technical and system training they have to learn. So it's nice to take them off the floor for a good 4 hours as well and do that kind of course. We also have, which was very interesting one, we built a confidence building course, and the reason we built it was because we had some clients that were asking us to build confidence for specific people who were going to in a team leader position, but part of the interview process was presentation skills. So they didn't obviously do presentation skills, but as a prelude to that, to just build their confidence of presenting themselves. So we built this confidence building course, and actually it's more, we're doing it, offering it more to frontline teams, you know, the employees, than we are to anyone else at the moment, regardless of the promotion. So it's an amazing, it's more of a workshop than a training course, but it's very engaging, very fun activities. And it is to explore the idea of confidence.
Yeah, exactly. And sort of building a proper foundation,
because
it might get rocky later on the top.
Completely.
All right.
And we also have a really lovely course, which we've done for various different employees across various different teams. And I'm smiling because we've had finance come into this. It's creative thinking. So it's called Get Creative With Your Thinking. And I hate the phrase think outside the box, but typically it's to try and get people to think alternatively, think more creatively. Now, senior people get really good value out of this because it applies to strategy. So it allows them to switch into where am I taking the business? What can I do differently? How can I think completely, completely out of the box, and then apply that into a business strategy? But for employees, it really challenges their belief system. Typically, finance people don't think they're creative, and then they go through this workshop and they're like, ah, I am creative. It just gets stimulated in different ways than typically other people would. So that's also a really engaging course for employees, and it also gets you to spot potential of that they are creative, yeah. that they've got more to give, yeah. and that they do think a little bit differently than other people. So mm-hmm. that's a really engaging course.
And even notice that in yourself.
Yeah, very much so.
So this is training about, you know, giving information, theoretical, but experiencing in an operational way. Obviously, you're given something because the company believes in you,
yeah.
right? So we were talking about 360 previously.
Yeah.
And I've talked to someone about this as well. But, I mean, it's heavy feedback. We discussed it last year, you and I, as
yes.
well. So you get feedback from your managers, from your peers, and from people reporting back into you.
Yeah.
Is this always positively received?
I think it depends on how the feedback mm. is presented to the individual. Mm. For me, I mean, I've experienced 360 from the other side. I've been through many 360 programs, especially working at eBay. It's one of the things that they were doing a lot of. So I've experienced it from the other side. And I think the fundamental that we bring to our program is how do we actually present that information back to the individual so that it's seen as an opportunity. I mean, one of the core things about 360 is I'm allowed to give people feedback. You know, this is my choice. As I give people feedback, what they choose to do with it is entirely up to themselves. So mm. if they don't want to take the feedback on board, that's entirely up to themselves. That's their choice. But it will hanker their development. It will hold them back a little bit more than other people who are tapping into that knowledge and doing something about it. So I wouldn't necessarily say 360 is ever, with us certainly, is negatively received. But I do think sometimes it's dismissed rather than negatively done.
I'm thinking where people are in life, in their own personal, emotional life.
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, you might be, one of the things that we experienced with a coaching client that had 360 but not through us,
mm-hmm.
was they were having a lot of personal issues in their personal life, and then they got some quite mm-hmm. negative feedback on their 360 report, and it kind of just sent them crashing.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, is about understanding the individual that you're feeding back to, and is this the right time to give them this feedback, and also how's that feedback given? And a lot of the things we've noticed with other companies who do 360s, and this comes from understanding it operationally because we've been through it, is they're not filtering the feedback. So sometimes when you have an anonymized 360, people use the opportunity to
exactly.
have a really good rant because it's not going to come back to them. And that's not valuable feedback for the other person. So if that's presented, that's quite negative.
Mm-hmm.
If we can go through as made you and we kind of look through what is blatantly a negative comment rather than a constructive comment, we can kind of dilute that out, and then the person receiving the feedback gets the constructive stuff, what they're doing amazing well and what can they do to improve. Now that is valuable feedback. The negativity is this person's useless and all this kind of comments
yeah.
that tend to come out.
Exactly.
That's negative feedback. Nobody can do anything about that. That's your personal opinion. But the constructive stuff, whether it's positive or constructive improvement,
mm-hmm.
that's where the value comes from. And
right, so you filter and clean the feedback up.
Only when we need to, and we see it very rarely, especially if it's been positioned as a program which is positively focused. This is empowering the individual. I mean, ultimately 360 is for the person, not for everyone else. It's for the person. It's empowering that person. So if it's done that way, then you would see less of these kind of comments coming out. But we do read through. I mean, we are obviously preparing for our feedback sessions with the individual, so we're reading through the reports quite heavily anyway. And then if we spot something that is going to add no value positively but could actually be detrimental, we would remove that out and just be aware. And typically what we would normally do then is feedback to HR to say somebody needs coaching on how they can give feedback to other people,
so
because
they can marry that.
Exactly. And then the next time it happens, that individual who didn't present themselves constructively has had some further coaching on how to give feedback
mm.
more constructively, and then hopefully the
managers have been more under pressure during COVID, so they continue with their own workload
mm-hmm.
that might actually increase, or constant increasing if you're a manager. But also you need to shout out and check in on your team members quite frequently to check mental health, probably even productivity. So managers are more exposed or more under pressure in,
yep.
in a remote setting. How is the 360, is that sort of adjusted to that, would you say?
I think the way I would, if it was us made you doing it, the way that we would do it is take into consideration what's happening each year and then adapt the way the questions are presented, particularly in that way. I think the other thing about 360 is this isn't particularly just focused on what you could do better. It's also focused on what you're doing really well. So it's just opportunities where there's opportunities to improve. But a valuable 360 is also about reinforcing what you're doing well. So if you've slipped the ball here and there, but you've really, you know, got your staff, the wellness is really sorted, the morale is really good, the motivation is good, especially in COVID situations, but some things have slipped, then we bring that to your attention, but we reinforce, oh my God, you did an amazing job with your team. I mean, this has come out really strong. So it's really about highlighting the positives as well as the can-do betters. But really, they should be equal, if not a little bit more focused on what's going well, because you want that manager to still do those things.
Exactly.
And if you put more emphasis on what they could do better, they might dilute this bit. And then next year, you've got the opposite. So it's like, no, we should put more emphasis on what they're doing amazing. So they keep doing an amazing job. And then if they have the opportunity to improve or they desire to improve on these other bits, then we typically do that. And what we notice as well when we do a 360, because we know that it's hard to concentrate on lots of personal development at the same time, is if somebody's got a few things coming out in their constructive elements that can do better, we only draw out the top two that for us, from made you, an external point of view, is these are two things you should really focus on. So there might be other things on the list, but these two things would really add value to them. So we look at what they're doing well, we can see that it might be easier for them to concentrate on these two things based on what they're doing well. So for this year, concentrate on these two things, and then next year we'll review again. 360 should just be an ongoing process. It's a good opportunity to keep pushing yourself and keep learning about yourself. So
The way that you're thinking of the 360 and sort of the positive attributes that comes out of it, it goes also very well in hand with the strengths finder that you're doing now.
Very much so.
Yeah, so that's more tuning up the positives that could be tuned up, that kind of approach to it.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I've been using StrengthFinder for over 18 years. Even before moving to Malta and retraining as a coach and a trainer, I was using it as a leader, a business leader, because I wanted to understand my team better, what their potential was, what their strengths were, also what their limitations were, but as a team, how I can kind of fill every gap. So if I've got a portfolio of work and it's not definitely decided it's going to this person, then how do I divvy this work out to get the best out of them? And typically, if you're playing to your strengths, you're going to be better at it, but you're also going to enjoy it because it's something you're good at, you enjoy.
Exactly.
So playing to those, but also looking at myself as a leader, as a look at my strengths and how do they compare with my team members and how do I need to adjust myself so that my direct reports are getting the best version of me for them, not the other way around. So I've been using it in that way. So it's a very positive psychology. It's my I've done the others. There's many other kind of personality profiles. I prefer StrengthFinder because it's very individualistic. I mean, I think last year we did 450 StrengthFinders and not one profile was the same. So for me, it's not putting people in boxes, giving them letters or colours. It's about this is who you are. But it does have that positive psychology basis, which is let's concentrate on what you do well and do more of that. Not ignoring the weaknesses, but how do we use what you do well to overcome the areas that are going to be challenges for you and use what you've got rather than trying to give you something that you're just never going to get there with.
So how do you, I mean, I can, you show you are inspired, but what else inspires you? And I'm thinking like for your own development, how do you keep updated? Obviously by the people that you meet and the different requests from the HR teams or management teams, but what other channels do you use?
So I'm a big fan of just absorbing information. In fact, you talk about StrengthFinder, one of my strengths is called input, and that is just the information gatherer. So I do have a very strong input, and I look at LinkedIn videos, I read a lot. I'm a big fan of reading. I mix non-fiction with fiction, but I get most of my inspiration for work from the non-fiction stuff. And I also can feel how I feel when I'm reading text or looking at videos or looking at other training presentations. Is this giving me value as an operational leader, or what are the tidbits in here that actually add value? And that's what I have. But we always talk about things. We're dealing with a lot of clients, we're dealing with a lot of industries, and we're dealing with some phenomenal HR teams. So there's always this just being open to I don't know it all. I'm never going to know it all, and I don't pretend to know it all, but I am really keen to gain more knowledge. So it's like everyone I'm speaking to or everything I'm digesting online or in person is taking that information in and understanding how can I use that to be a better Luke, but also how can I use that to make a better Made You and have more impact to the people that we need to help. So,
I mean, it's trending. Everything's trending all the time.
Completely.
So it's to adapt, and that's from the voice of the horse, or how do you say it, straight from the horse's mouth.
Yes.
to be flexible.
Yes, very much
to the needs.
Yeah.
Awesome. What have we not covered?
I think the only other thing that we haven't covered, which we've started doing off the back of 360, is, and this comes from my days at eBay, is when it comes to end of year performance reviews, what we used to do was get the managers together to evaluate the next level down, but as a group, so that was being much more objective. So when it comes to end of year performance reviews, I'm not being either benefited or hurt by the fact of my manager's opinion. It's much more of a collective at that level. So we've been doing a lot of these performance calibration sessions, particularly at the end of the year with some companies, to align their end of year performance. So categorizing their staff into, are they underperforming, outperforming, top performing, just steady performing, but getting all that kind of collective group to evaluate their team, typically starting with C-level to evaluate their heads of level, if heads of is the next level down, and the heads of to discuss their senior managers. And it really brings that kind of objectiveness to it. And if we can bring 360 in there as well, as because 360 comes out with a rating of whether, you know, where this person sits, it also adds this kind of even more external objectivity to it as well. So we've been picking up a lot of this performance calibration work as well.
So for performance, possibly productivity, but maybe for culture as well.
Completely.
How much signals does that send to, like, to the organization in terms of, so this, you're saying your culture is this, but it's actually this, you should build on this.
Very much so. And I mean, we see a lot that's coming through this, but it does tend to align with culture, values and mission. I mean, we, even the way we build 360s is, if a company has very hearty values or a hearty culture, then we will build a 360 to reinforce these values.
Oh, okay.
I think we've done a lot of work with companies developing their culture, values and missions, and one of the things that gets there is, how do we transition it from wonderful words on the wall that everyone forgets to actually people embracing these values. And I think, again, and I'm going to use the word again, but it's really important, is if we make it operationally focused, so how do we change these values into the operations, that's when people engage with them. They don't necessarily remember the names, or they don't remember what the values are particularly, but they're living and breathing them. And actually, that's what you want from your culture, values and missions, is people to live and breathe them. Not necessarily, you know, the CEO walks around and says, what are values, and you can't remember. That's not the test of the values-based culture. It's a case of, are they living and breathing them? So the more we can align 360 to values, culture and potentially mission, and the more we can align performance calibration with that as well, it really reinforces it operationally. And that's when people start to live and breathe this kind of thing.
So if you see this program now in August, how is Luke, Kelly's and Richard's schedule for the coming autumn? If you get inspired and sort of really want to hook up with you guys.
So I think if you get inspired and you really want to hook up with us, we have bookings that are going into Q1, Q2 next year. I mean, we are already seeing people booking in, especially as they're using their budgets. But we always have the element, we to take on more clients, more work, and definitely we will be having a conversation. It's not a case of saying no. It would be possibly a case of saying, we can start this then, or start this later. But we really, and you know this as well, Heidi, from your time working with us at the businesses you've worked in, is we really work in partnership. It's when we are a provider, and I don't want to sound cliche about things, but we really do work very closely with the people that we're speaking to.
Why you're here today.
Completely. So that's how we do things. So the conversation would still happen, and we will make sure that we deliver the best program, however that sits, for the individual client that's contacting us, and also at the opportune time as well that suits that particular client as well. So they just need to get in touch, and the conversations start there.
Fantastic. It's August. It's getting really, really warm around
very hot, yes.
Malta. Shall we go out for a cool breeze?
Yes, very much so.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming, Luke.
You're very welcome.
Amazing having you here.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.